Hey, it's Francis Lam. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you ever want more info on anything you hear on our show, you can always find it at splendidtable.org. Recipes, videos, more on our guests, and you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about getting you good things to eat and make on weeknights. But right now, here's this week's podcast. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Francis Lam. Osayi Endolin is a writer who grew up in California with a Nigerian father. But their relationship was difficult. Her parents divorced, and Osayi mostly put him and her link to Nigerian culture aside, until she moved to the South. She wrote a lovely, searching story for the Southern Foodways Alliance's quarterly, Gravy, about how eating in the South reminded her of her father's Nigerian food, and how she's trying to reconnect to her heritage. Osayi, so good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Francis.
I want to start at the beginning of your story. There's this moment where you're working at a fine dining, modern Southern restaurant, and you come upon a traditional Southern dish that you'd never heard of before, but it reminded you of some of the Nigerian food that you grew up with.
Yeah.
Tell us about that moment.
I was working at Empire State South in Midtown Atlanta, and this was several years ago. We were at Family Meal, which is in restaurants before dinner service. The staff gets together and they eat. And it's a meal that's cooked by someone in the kitchen who has a number of other things to do. So usually this meal is pretty simple, just to get everybody fed and ready to start a long shift. So this particular afternoon, the meal was special because it was just so ornate. One of the guys on the line at that time cooked this meal of herb roasted chicken, cornbread slathered with sorghum butter, and this side dish called Hoppin' John. And everyone was murmuring and kind of like, ooh, you know, because this meal, you know, smelled and looked so delicious. But I didn't know what Hoppin' John was. And so I asked, and I got these weird looks. And I was very quickly instructed that this was a common staple of Black Southern cooking, and sort of with a friendly eyebrow raise, kind of like, you need to know what this is. That's when I got my introduction to this dish of rice and black-eyed peas with bits of meat and onions and tomatoes and some of the customs around it. And I thought, oh, well, this is kind of familiar because my mom would sometimes make black-eyed peas. And then when I spooned the dish into my bowl and started eating it, I was like, oh, well, okay, I'm kind of getting this because my dad also cooked a dish that it was called Ewa Dodo. This was one of many moments that I had working at that restaurant where I started to connect many aspects of Southern cuisine with not just the history of enslaved people, but directly with stuff that my father would make or talk about.
Hmm. And your relationship with your father, you write, has been hard for a long time, it sounds like. And you wrote that when you were a kid, his kitchen philosophy was a man needs his space, which is to say
right.
that he was intimidating and you were not allowed in the kitchen. So what was it like for you to be in that kitchen?
It was like peeking into a world you couldn't access, which is strange because I had a lot of free reign in the kitchen growing up. You know, I'd come home after school and my brother and I would make snacks, and you know, I always had chores in the kitchen. But when Dad was in there, you know, I don't want to over romanticize it, but it was almost like he was just in this zone and he didn't want you in there and he was just doing this thing. And you know, the outcome was always so family oriented. So it always kind of struck me as odd that the time he spent cooking was so off limits.
What do you think it meant for him to be cooking that food?
I think about that a lot now. And I think that it must have been very maybe even sacred. I don't know. There were a lot of things I remember, like not being able to get my dad to care very much about. You know, he would show up for stuff, you know, band recitals and things like that. But I mean, that was something that just always had 100% of his attention. And I think coming to this country, he was, I think, barely 18. And for years, he didn't return home. And, you know, both his parents died years apart, but while he was in California. And, you know, I think sometimes of just how isolating it can be being a West Coaster in the Southeast in certain experiences. I can't imagine some of the challenges he must have gone through being not just from another country, but also from a part of the world that most Americans tend to look at with sort of a downcast gaze. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't tend to look at Africa and its many countries as a place of aspiration or inspiration, even though there's so much going on there that is to be admired. Sure. We tend to focus on and only hear about the things that are tragic and hard and sad. So, you know, maybe for him that cooking, you know, was a time to think about just a space that, you know, none of us could go. Mm. And maybe that's why we weren't invited in.
And then your parents split.
Right. When that split happened, you know, we moved with my mom and, you know, I realized, okay, there's no Nigerian food in the house anymore. It was kind of just this sort of subtext that it's not something anyone really talked about, but, you know, you notice it. And so for many years, I didn't eat Nigerian food. Now my relationship is kind of one of reuniting. And, you know, along with that comes lessons and stories and corrections being made to me about how to pronounce things or, mm-hmm. you know, what gets served with what. I mean, so some of my memories don't line up with things I see on the menu. So I'm sort of trying to play this puzzle game, putting things back together.
It's interesting because the emotional relationship people have to food, you know, it can be varied. It can be all kinds of things. But for a lot of people, especially when they're immigrants or the children of immigrants, I feel like the things that people really hold on to are these sort of like warm and fuzzy memories of when we were kids. This is what we ate as a family. And I want to preserve that memory. I never want to let that go. And in your case, it is sort of a different thing because those family memories are not necessarily entirely warm and fuzzy. So it's not just a matter of nostalgia. It sounds like you feel like you need to actively learn about this culture that you have a stake in. So how do you go about learning about it then, like you said, like in some ways as an insider, in some ways as an outsider?
Right. Someone recently told me, gosh, it sounds like you almost come from a biracial background because, you know, you have these two family experiences that are so disjointed in some ways. And you're kind of the only, like you're the only indicator of that mix. And it is very bifurcated. And what kind of helped propel me is kind of been looking at the way West African cuisine has influenced the way that we eat. People are talking about it more. It's actually becoming a little bit more visible. It, you know, it shouldn't surprise us that given that so much of how we eat comes from the Southern tradition, that it was West Africans and Black Americans who really helped shape a lot of the way we eat now. But that blows people's mind when you frame it that way. And, you know, it's almost like they start quizzing you. Well, like how and like what? And, you know, you can kind of list, well, you know, you've got produce that came as part of that forced migration. And you've got black eyed peas, you've got okra, you've got the rice that was developed in South Carolina, you know, I mean, you have all these different kind of hash marks where you can see along the way. And then, of course, so much scholarship has been done around the recipes and who was cooking. And, you know, that has its own place in the story as well. And I'm interested in understanding a little bit more about that flow of history. And, you know, I have this Nigerian name that I'm always, always, always having to talk to people about because that's one of the first things that people want to know about me, even just in passing. Like if I'm on the phone with a customer service representative, like that's how they want to spend the whole time, like talking to me about the origin of my name. And so I'm constantly telling this story. And then that's kind of, for a long time, that's kind of all I had to say, right? I mean, it was just like, well, this is my name and this is what it means and this is where my father is from and that's the end. And I'm now just beginning to open that up a little bit more.
Yeah. And so do you cook Nigerian food for yourself now?
I don't yet, but I'm getting there. And I don't know why it's so hard. I read something recently, and I wish I could remember her title, but she's currently, I think, in Bill de Blasio's administration, and she was saying how she didn't feel like she could cook her mother's, maybe her mother's or her grandmother's recipes. Like it just was like a line she didn't want to cross. And I mean, I don't even have recipes, you know what I mean? It's like, it's like the period of my life where I might have been invited into the kitchen or been able to have those kinds of conversations with my dad, we were separated. So it's taken a lot for me to just claim this as my own story.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Sai.
Thanks for having me, Francis.
Osayi Endelin is working on a book about the West African origins of how Americans eat. You can find her on Twitter at Osayi Endelin. Well, there are thousands of recipes for Hop and John, but we have a great one for you. It's from Chef Sean Brock of Husk and McCrady's. Find his Low Country Hop and John at splendidtable.org. Coming up, what the most basic roast chicken can teach you about cooking and life, with the chef and living legend Jacques Pepin. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Francis Lamb. If you pay attention to chefs and restaurants and food media these days, it's pretty much a given that the chef is a visionary, and every plate is their artistic expression, and to imply anything else is an insult. But it really wasn't always this way. As a chef I talked to once said, well, you know, we used to basically be servants, and somewhere along the line we became geniuses. But Jacques Pepin is from the old school, a living legend who did as much as anyone to bring classical French cooking to the American consciousness. And he has always insisted that while cooking can be thought of as art, what's really important is the nuts and bolts of it. His new book is Poulet and Legume. Chef, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I noticed in your new book, the very first recipe is for a simple roast chicken. No brining, no spicing, just a hot pan and a hot oven. And so let me ask you, why is a simple roast chicken such an iconic dish for French chefs?
For different reasons. It's like, an hard-cooked egg, something that there is no recovery if you don't do it right. Of course, the quality of the chicken is very, very important. The quality of the pan that you cook it in, you know, you cook that with a thin stainless steel pan, and the heat transfer is bad. So the juice which comes out and crystallizes in the bottom of the pan, that's what we call the glaze. Well, with a stainless steel pan, the glaze burns. The quality of the pan, the quality of the chicken, piece of butter, and of course a hot oven, that's all important.
You know, I love hearing you say this because it's one of the things that I learned in cooking school and also continue to learn, not just in cooking, but also in life. And that's the more seemingly simple something is, the more you learn to see the different details that really matter that maybe you didn't even realize would have mattered before. Like you said, the quality of the pan actually really matters. But so what separates in your mind a good cook from a great one?
First, I mean, for me, you start with technique, you know, because the technique that is the manipulation, you know, the manual dexterity of a chef, for me, is important. You have to become a technician first, whether you're a shoemaker or a cabinet maker or a surgeon, for that matter, or a cook, you have to know your trade, or whether you're a painter. I paint, too. I mean, you can spend 2 years in art school and learn how to mix yellow and blue and to make green with that and do something with your thumb or with a spatula or with a brush. And after 2 years, you can stand in front of a landscape and do one painting after another. Does that make you an artist? Not really, but at that level, you're a good technician. If you happen to have talent, however, then the technique themselves make you show that talent much better. And I know a lot of chefs, you know, and I'm not saying that in a derogatory way. A small restaurant who run a restaurant, do a good food cost and run the kitchen well, and they have not much talent, but they are good technicians. They can run the kitchen. The food is good. It's okay, fine. But if you happen to have talent and put a little love in it too, then you get to someone like, you know, Thomas Keller or Jean-Georges or Daniel in New York or Roland Passot here, someone with a great chef, you know.
Mm. And so for you, when you're cooking, maybe at home, what are you enjoying cooking right now?
I do. I mean, I'm always hungry, so as long as I'm hungry, I'm cooking. And I've been married 50 years, and for me, the end of the day is really sitting down with my wife and sharing a bottle, sometimes two bottles of wine, and having dinner. It's a ritual, you know, which is very important to us, and we've done that forever. But you see, years ago, certainly in the 50s and 60s, when I worked at the Plaza Athénée in Paris or when I came to New York, the idea was to conform. The chef was not a star, you know. I mean, we are genius now. I don't know what happened. But at that time, the idea was to conform. So you work in a place like the Plaza Athénée in Paris, which was well known, still known for the lobster souffle that they used to do. And I think there was, we were 50 chefs in the kitchen. I believe that the 50 chefs, any one of us could have done that lobster souffle, you would never have known which one had done it, because it was a way of conforming. You would work somewhere with a great chef and you try to imitate, you try to learn the trade this way. Not to express yourself, that didn't really exist too much at the time. Now, of course, it's the opposite. The chef in the kitchen say, I want to sign that dish and make sure that people know I am the one who created that dish. It gives certainly a great deal of pressure to the chef in the kitchen, who has to kind of reinvent himself all the time and try to come out with something different or something new. I don't really find anything that exciting about something new, because it's new by itself. I would rather have, again, a roast chicken or something like that, that I know I can go to that restaurant and each time it's just about perfect. And, you know, to keep that level of consistency requires a great deal of creativity at different levels, because whether you like it or not, there is no two chicken which are the same amount of fat, the same amount of freshness in it or whatever, the quality of the chicken, the quality of anything else. So each time, in order to get to that same dish and have the same taste each time, then you have minute change that happened along the way, which are sometimes conscious and sometimes they are subconscious, you know, but you change to adjust, and eventually you get there.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because sometimes the question I like to ask chefs and try to get at their philosophy, sometimes I like to ask them, you know, is it more exciting for you to cook something new or to cook something again? And hearing you talk just makes me think, you know, the cook something again question is not really different than cooking something new.
Yes.
Because when you cook something again, if you learn all the technique and you learn to see the details, it's sort of cooking something new every time. Uh-huh. Because you have to adjust every time.
Absolutely. And that's where, you know, a restaurant is made, you know, by being consistent and good each time you go.
Oui, chef. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's always an incredible pleasure. Jacques Pepin's latest book is Poulet and Legume, My Favorite Chicken and Vegetable Recipes. Jacques left us with a recipe for something a little more involved and a little less nerve-wracking than a perfect roast chicken. It's for one of his all-time favorites, chicken jardiniere. Find it at splendidtable.org, and while you're there, subscribe to our podcast. You know what a veggie burger is. You know, it's usually made from beans or soy protein or like some mashed up grains with some little flecks of carrot to make it feel like you're eating something healthy. But a tech company called Impossible Foods has just released what they think will be the future of sustainable meat. And I mean meat with quotation marks. Burgers made from plants that have been made to mimic the molecular structure of meat, down to starting out red and raw. Kurt Soller wrote about this company for the Wall Street Journal, and we caught up with him to find out what these burgers are all about. Kurt, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Francis.
So I think most people know, you know, what a veggie burger is, and most people know what like a fake meat kind of veggie burger is, like, you know, the kind of thing where it's like ground up soy protein or whatever. And, you know, frankly, I think it tastes pretty good because I had a vegetarian mom growing up. But I think, you know, most people don't think of it as actually being meat and they call it fake meat. But this, the Impossible Burger, is not really the same thing, I don't think, right? It's not exactly that. It is meat, but it's made of vegetables. Can you explain what the Impossible Burger is?
Gladly. So the Impossible Burger was developed by Pat Brown, who's a biochemist out in Stanford. He's basically reverse engineering things that you would find in nature to make something that resembles a burger. So, you know, there's protein that comes from wheat. There's fat that comes from coconuts. And then the real breakthrough is this thing called heme. That comes from the roots of legumes, things like soybeans. But what it does is it works as a catalyst. It sort of gives flavor to these things in the same way that myoglobin gives flavor to meat in regular cow meat. You know, it's sort of heme essentially approximates what blood is to a real burger.
So when people talk about, oh, this burger bleeds, I mean, like, it was so weird that everyone talked about, like, is a burger that bleeds? I'm like, real meat doesn't bleed.
No.
But there's blood in it. That's what we
exactly.
mean.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, it has that red quality. In fact, I went out to the lab and I sort of saw them put this together in every step. And if they cut into some of these legumes on the root level, you can see a sort of tiny little red dot. It's that thing that they're sort of taking and they're sort of fermenting yeast and getting that at a large enough level to put into a burger and sell it.
And again, the idea is they have found a way to take plants, extract things from plants, mm-hmm. and recombine them in a way that they are creating essentially meat.
Exactly. You know, at what point is meat from a cow only or from a cow exclusively? Because that's the thing they're going after. You know, the reason for doing all of this is that cows are terrible for the environment, terrible for our food supply in a lot of ways, at least according to Pat Brown at Stanford, who's developing all this.
Yeah. Terrible meaning you have to feed a cow so much feed and you give a cow so much water. And there's a great line you have in the story where he says, cows are a very inefficient technology.
Yeah, you know, and also, you know, they release a lot of methane gas, which is bad for our ozone layer. You know, from every level, whether it's putting things into them or getting meat out of them, it's not great for our environment.
And do you think people who are meat eaters are going to look at this and be like, hey, looks like it tastes good enough for me, or are they going to be wigged out?
Yeah, you know, so I went out to California when I wrote this story, and I spent some time in the lab, and then they ended up cooking a burger for me. And I went in really skeptical. I did not think that it was going to taste good. I love a burger. Who doesn't love a burger? And it tasted pretty similar to a burger. The thing is, though, that it doesn't have that same sort of, you know, carnal satisfaction of eating a burger. And they're going to have to get past that. You know, I think people are not going to eat something just because they know it's good for the environment. That's not a selling point enough. They will eat something because they think it's delicious and because they think it's as good as the burger that they already have.
But what's missing? Because they have like scientifically engineered this to be like they got like the aroma of sizzled meat and they managed to make it so it will produce the aroma of sizzled meat. So in your mind, what was missing when you ate it?
You know, it's just not as beefy. You know, it's shockingly beefy compared to any other vegetarian option that you've had. And, you know, it sizzles, as you were saying, when you cook it, and it sort of tenses up and those fats seize when you cook it. So it sort of looks and feels and sounds like a burger. But when you bite into it, it has a sort of cereal-y note to it. You know, it just doesn't have that like depth and richness that I think we associate with ground beef.
Hmm. And is it like a recipe thing? Like, do you think they can get there?
You know, I think it'll get there. You know, when I had it in San Francisco, there was a lot of condiments on it, pickles and Dijonnaise and a bunch of other stuff. And I actually had it here in New York when David Chang made it, and it was much simpler. You know, he used non-vegan cheese. He used actual, you know, dairy cheese. He used Martin's potato roll bun. And it tasted more like a burger in that instance. And I think they're constantly refining it. And because they're set up in a lab, they can keep tweaking it and changing it, you know. And so I think it'll get there.
Yeah. But I wonder, do you think it's because you knew what you were eating?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. You know, going into any of this, I think that we know too much. You know, I like spent a lot of time researching this, and I saw it coming together in a lab, and I saw it coming from, you know, these giant metal vats that look, you know, nothing like a cow. But if I were a consumer and I was discovering this in the butcher aisle of my supermarket, which is where they hope that it lands, I might take it home. I might try it. I might be pleasantly satisfied. And, you know, I think the less you know in this instance, maybe the more appealing it would be.
Yeah. It's like seeing the sausage get made.
Yeah, you don't necessarily want to know. I mean, it's like when you go to a restaurant, you really don't want to know how most things come together. You just want to enjoy them.
Right. I want to get back to this idea of, you know, it tasting almost like beef, but not quite. And I think, you know, there's this idea of the uncanny valley.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is like, you know, if you're watching a movie with real actors, that's fine. And you're watching a movie and it's animated, that's fine. But if you watch a movie that's like animated and they look almost like real people, but mm-hmm. not quite, it makes you really uncomfortable.
Yeah, totally. And as I mentioned in the piece, like sort of the closer it gets to being a real burger, the more you can sort of see the slight flaws in it. Like who knows how much of that cereal note I would have picked up if I had just taken this at a restaurant and enjoyed it and sort of thought about it on its face value. But because I'm comparing it to this thing that I've had thousands of times, it's really easy to sort of tell the difference between the two things.
Yeah. But you spent a lot of time with these people for this story. Again, a great story. And the CEO of the company sounds like a fascinating dude. He's a biochemist. His father worked for the CIA. Mm-hmm. They have over $180 million of investment. Mm-hmm. There's a lot riding on this. There's an expectation that this is really going to be the future of meat. I think that's what they're thinking. I'm sure that's their elevator pitch. Do you think this is the future of meat?
I do. I think this is a huge problem that, you know, the great minds of Silicon Valley and everyone else knows we need to solve. And I think that this is definitely the sort of leading company in that field. There are a number of other companies who are doing this as well. You know, there's just Mayo, who's trying to sort of help our egg supply. There's Beyond Meat, which is sort of doing a very similar thing to Impossible Food. And I think all of these companies sort of working together, and, you know, some of those companies also have huge investors like Bill Gates behind them, are solving more or less the same problem. And one of them will sort of have a breakthrough that really hits with consumers. And that will be the true test, you know, like any other consumer product, whichever one sort of wins that market share is the one that's going to take off.
Right on. So I'll come see you in a year when you have a barbecue and we'll talk about what goes
some,
on
yeah.
the grill. Yeah.
You know, I would love, they didn't let me cook one myself, and I would love to actually get one in my hands and sort of cook it at home and see how I feel about it. Because certain things cannot be done with it right now. It can be made into a burger really well, but it's not necessarily going to be the right beef for like meatloaf or something like that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So in a year from now, we'll try the impossible meatloaf.
Yeah, yeah. I'll have you over.
Kurt, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Kurt Soller is the features editor at Bon Appetit. His article, "The Impossible Burger is Ready for Its Meatless Close-Up," appeared in the Wall Street Journal. But if you're in the mood for a charmingly retro, old-fashioned veggie burger made with vegetables that don't bleed, try Lucas Volger's spinach chickpea burger. You can find the recipe at splendidtable.org. Every week, we check in with our friends at America's Test Kitchen to get caught up on their latest, their tests, their tastings, and their general good cooking advice. This week, Tucker Shaw, who heads up the Cook's Country team at America's Test Kitchen, takes on a New Jersey classic with our managing producer, Sally Swift.
Hey, Tucker, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me today. I appreciate it.
So you have done a story recently that has set off a flurry of controversy.
We have.
And it is about crumb buns. I mean, I'm a Midwesterner. I have no idea what the controversy could be. Can you tell me what a crumb bun is?
So this is our favorite kind of controversy because it deals with dessert. A crumb bun is a New Jersey original. You probably have had experience with a crumb bun. You just don't know it. You probably came across something called a crumb cake.
Okay.
It's basically a sheet cake that has a streusel topping on top. Now, here's the thing. When you cut it into squares, it becomes a bun if you are in New Jersey. But in New Jersey, rather than a light crumbly sort of restrained crumble of streusel on top, they really go to town with the crumbs. So we're looking at a 1-to-1 ratio of crumbs to cake.
And wow,
that makes
really?
It better. Yeah. I mean, go big or go home, right?
That's crazy. So, it's not like a coffee cake then. It's deep with crumbles.
Very similar to a coffee cake. I mean, there's a family tree of snack cakes and coffee cakes and cake cakes and that kind of thing. But no, it's not a frosted cake. It's really just a square of white cake that's made with a yeasted dough. So it gives sort of a nice yeasty flavor. And then on top is a mountain of crumbs. And, you know, normally or oftentimes you will see people eating a crumb cake and just picking off the crumbs and leaving the cake aside. This solves that problem by totally going crazy with the crumbs on the top.
So you guys developed a recipe for it. Can you fill me in on what we need to do at home?
Well, the first step in developing this recipe was to find a New Jersey native on our staff who knew about these things and knew exactly what we were going for. So we employed Katie Laird, who's one of the test cooks in the kitchen, and she grew up with this thing. So she headed up our team in developing this recipe.
That seems wise to get a New Jersey native.
I mean, you might as well get somebody who really knows the thing, you know?
So what was the key to this?
The key to this is In order to get that many crumbs to sit comfortably on top of a piece of cake, you have to have a fairly sturdy base. So what we did for the cake layer was experiment with different types of flours. And as you know, flours have different protein contents. The higher the protein content, the more sort of structure your final baked good will have. We ended up using all-purpose flour here, which has about a 10 to 12% protein content. And that gave us a nice sturdy base, still tender enough to bite through easily, but it gave enough structure so that we could start piling the crumbs on top and they would stay in place.
And the crumbs are the magic ingredient, right?
The crumbs are the magic ingredient, and it's a combination of sugar and flour and butter and a little bit of cinnamon, just like you would expect in a streusel. But rather than using all-purpose flour in the crumbs, we turned things on their head a little bit here and used cake flour in the crumbs. Now, cake flour has a lower protein content, so it produces a more tender product in the end. This gives us crumb with plenty of crunch and a nice amount of texture, but they don't turn hard, so it's not something that is difficult to bite through. So you kind of get the best of both.
Well, it sounds like it's a pretty great recipe, an easy recipe to duplicate at home.
Super easy and totally rewarding. Really great recipe.
Hey, Tucker, thanks for filling us in.
Thanks for having me today, Sally.
Tucker Shaw runs the Cook's Country team at America's Test Kitchen. You can find their foolproof recipe for those New Jersey crumb buns at splendidtable.org. And coming up, your calls and our contributor, the New York Times' Melissa Clark, talks to Dan Pashman of The Sporkful about the lunch order that may have changed the world. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. We're taking your calls this hour. Give us a ring, 1-800-537-5252, or send us questions via Facebook and Twitter. Let's do this. Hey, we have Aaron calling. Hey, Aaron, where are you calling from?
Washington, D.C.
What do you want to talk about?
So since I've been in D.C., I've really gotten into Szechuan food because we actually have a couple of really good restaurants here that have Szechuan food. And I want to be able to cook it in my own home. But it's kind of hard to find, you know, where the real authentic recipes are.
Sure, sure. I think in English.
Yes, please, English.
The key person is Fuchsia Dunlop. She is an English food writer who went to China, fell in love with Szechuan food, and I believe is the first Western graduate of this great culinary school. I forget the name of the school, but it's like the Great Szechuan Institute of Culinary Education. It's like some like super impressive title.
Oh.
And she has a number of books, but her first book is Land of Plenty. And it is a modern classic. It really, really, really okay. Goes like soup to nuts, everything you need to know to really start getting into Szechuan cooking. Someone else who's really interesting is a woman based in Nashville. Her name is Taylor Holiday, and she's a journalist who adopted a daughter from China, but not like a baby. Her daughter was, I think, maybe like 9 or 10 years old. And so her mission was to learn to cook Szechuan food for her daughter. Make it like home for her. And she has this blog called The Mala Project that's sort of all about that.
Oh,
yeah,
perfect.
It's about her digging through lots of different cookbooks and really trying to learn this cuisine.
I mean, you know, we have a lot of Asian grocery stores around here, but I'm assuming that like most of the key ingredients for Szechuan cooking are pretty standard, right? I mean, like fish sauce, garlic, chili.
Yeah, if you have access to an Asian grocery, I think you'll do pretty well. The one thing that's a little tricky, and I think less so now, is Szechuan peppercorn, which is really key to the cuisine.
Well, that's the mala,
yeah,
right?
It's the thing that gives you that sort of tingling feeling in your mouth and this very fruity, really beautiful fruity aroma. It's like a little bit of an acquired taste, I think, for some people because that tingling feeling is just so weird. But
yeah, but you get hooked.
Yeah, you totally get hooked. and they pair it with hot chilies so that it both numbs you and like sets you on fire at the same time. So your brain totally like splits in half and you're like, oh my God, what's going on? This is amazing.
Yeah,
and they used to be illegal to import for a long, long time, but now you can actually get real Szechuan peppercorns again. So if you've never seen them by themselves, it's like if you imagine a pink peppercorn, but kind of split in half, like it was split open.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're actually really beautiful looking. They look almost like tiny beetles, but in like a nice way. Like with the wings open.
The
or like ladybugs. They look more like ladybugs with the wings open.
That's more appetizing, yeah.
So have fun.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
Absolutely.
So, hey, call us at 1-800-537-5252. Hi, Thomas. Where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from Manassas, Virginia.
Manassas, Virginia. Right on. So what do you want to talk about today?
I'm a really big fan of making my own salsa, but just a recent college grad, new apartment kitchen, and don't have a food processor. So I'm wondering, what are some like dip salsa recipes that I can make with a mortar and pestle and really shoddy knife skills?
Well, you do have a mortar and pestle, so that's awesome. Wait, okay, so you don't have a food processor, but do you have a blender?
Yeah. I don't have a blender, no.
Okay. I am not going to tell you what to do with your life, but get a blender.
Get a blender, okay.
You're going to want my drinks. You just graduated. You're going to have parties. It's going to be great. But before you get to the blender, I'm happy to talk about blender and food processor-free salsas. And it's awesome that you have a mortar and pestle. Is it the big kind that you can fit a lot of stuff in, or is it kind of more like a spice grinder kind?
Yeah, no, it's a pretty big mortar and pestle.
Awesome. You know,
my theory being there probably were salsas that existed before blenders, so there's got to be a recipe on there.
Yeah, I mean, the whole world is open to you if you have that, because like you said, like, traditionally, almost any salsa was made with that technology. So, you know, here's a really, really, really basic thing to do. Let heat do the work for you.
Okay.
Lots and lots and lots of salsas are actually cooked, not raw. And in part, it's to produce flavor, but in part, I think it's also to like help break down the ingredients and make them, you know, really soft. So when you start mashing them, or even if you really just use a knife and start cutting them, they'll kind of just pulp up on their own, you know, and you end up with something that's, you know, not like pico de gallo, not like a salad essentially that you can pick up with a chip, but something that is more like a sauce and more like a dip. And a really basic one that I love is probably all the same ingredients that you would normally use, but again, you let heat do some work for you. So what I would do is you fire up a broiler and put your tomatoes on a pan. No oil, don't bother. Just throw them under the broiler on high and just really like burn them. Like just let them go. Mm-hmm. You can do this if you want to do it with the thing where like you turn on the flame if you have a gas stove. I like to do it under the broiler because if it starts to gush juice, it doesn't get your stove gross. And really just let it go like 5, 7, 10 minutes until it's really nice and charred on one side. Flip it, char the other side, really get a nice even layer of char all around the tomatoes, or the tomatillos are obviously traditional and amazing. And then all the other ingredients too, kind of get some of that smoky char action on them too. So what I would do is you take a cast iron pan, put it on medium, medium high flame and just let it go for 5 minutes. You really got to give it time on the stove for the pan to heat all the way through and really collect that heat energy. And when you're ready to go there, I would put maybe a clove of garlic in the skin. You can put some chilies down in the pan, some white onion that you've sliced into like quarter inch slices, and just lay them all down and just let them char. You flip them after, you know, 4, 5, 6 minutes. And you get nice char on both sides. And then you basically take everything. At that point, you can take the garlic out of the skin. And then you can throw it all in your mortar and pestle and just mash it all together. And what comes out is this really deep, intense, smoky sauce. And obviously salt and pepper, you know, do that thing to taste. You can kind of go wild with it. Yeah. And once you get that sort of really basic one down, you can start adding all kinds of stuff. You know, you can do toasted seeds, toasted nuts, certainly spices. A little bit of cinnamon is actually traditional in a lot of salsas. You can throw in like a hit of tequila or mezcal. It's a really wide and generous world that you're going to get into.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you.
Yeah, have fun.
Thanks.
You know, you can always send us your Splendid Table questions via Facebook and Twitter, or go Graham Bell and call us at 1-800-537-5252. When Joseph McNeil sat down at a Woolworths counter in 1960, he just wanted to order some coffee and pie. A simple thing, but a simple thing denied to African Americans in the age of segregation, to remind them that they were less than. Thanks to him and the other men of the Greensboro Four things started to change as people staged sit-ins at lunch counters all across the South, exposing themselves to savage abuse and violence. But they stayed still, and they stayed strong, and segregation began to crack. Some people say food shouldn't be political, but politics are all about power. So how can something as powerful as food not be political? A few months ago, Dan Pashman and I got in touch. He's the host of a great podcast called The Sporkful, and he wanted to talk to me about an essay I'd written a few years ago, asking why certain chefs can become famous cooking the food from other people's cultures. He was planning a series of shows he called Other People's Food, looking at the complicated issues around food and culture and who owns what. And one thing he looked into was the story of the Greensboro Four. New York Times columnist Melissa Clark sat down with Dan to talk about it.
Dan, welcome.
Thanks, Melissa.
So you've been working on a podcast called Other People's Food, where you talk about the relationship between race and food. And I'd love you to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was sort of inspired by a lot of what we've seen of recent events, some of the recent violence. Race and culture certainly have been big issues as of late, but it seems like whenever anyone tries to have a conversation about it, it quickly devolves into sort of shouting and one side against another side. And we thought, maybe if we begin the conversation with food, you know, something so universal, maybe we could get it to a different place where it wasn't all shouting.
So recently you spoke to Joseph McNeil. Tell us who he is and why he's important.
Joseph McNeil is a great civil rights leader. He's one of the original members of the Greensboro Four, who were a group of four African-American college students back in 1960 in Greensboro, North Carolina, who staged a sit-in at a segregated lunch counter. At a Woolworth lunch counter, and their protest sparked a bunch of other protests at restaurants and lunch counters across the South and across the U.S. that helped to integrate a lot of restaurants in America. And so he had a huge impact, and I was very fortunate to get to sit down with him. We went out to lunch at a diner on Long Island, and we started off with him just telling me a little bit about some of the events in his life that led up to his protest.
It came to a head at a Richmond bus station. I ordered a hamburger and was told I had to go to the rear of the bus station. And that ticked me off. And then I realized how deep this thing was and that it was going to stay like this unless we changed it. So I went back to the dormitory that evening, confronted my friends and said, listen, we've talked and talked and talked. When are we going to act?
Like, it's such a simple thing, sitting down to eat. You know, like you and I just both walked into this diner and we sat down together to eat.
60 years ago, we tried this maneuver. Right. We'd be confronted.
Which isn't that long ago.
In the scheme of things and lifespans, you're right on.
Right. It's so hard for me to wrap my brain around the idea that what you and I are doing right now would have been a cause for controversy.
Segregation was pervasive. It was everywhere. Even in a McDonald's, you were required to go to the rear of a McDonald's and place your order. And of course, we all know the absurdity of colored water, colored access to the beach, no access to hotels if you're traveling and you're tired.
And so that moment, you walk into the Woolworths on that day, February 1st, 1960, and you go and you sit down on this stool at the counter where no African American, as far as we know, had ever sat at that counter. And you take that seat, and what was going through your head in that moment where you first sat down?
There's lots of uncertainty. How was the crowd of people who gathered around us going to react? How was the store manager going to react? But we faced at that time the possibility of arrest. We were aware of people who defied segregation. We were aware of what happened to Emmett Till. So all these things were operating in the background because it could have happened to us.
I know there was one moment several hours into that first day sitting there where a cop came in and he started sort of brandishing his club.
Yes.
He was walking back and forth. You guys are sitting at the counter in a row of four of you, and he's sort of, sounds like he was sort of pacing back and forth behind you, tapping his club into his hand.
Threatening, menacing.
Right.
Other patrons started to gather around saying, you see those four colored boys over there? And the word started to spread that four colored boys were sitting down at a Woolworth store saying they're not going to leave until they're served. There was an elderly white woman. She was watching the scene from the time we sat down. And she got up and started walking towards us. And Frank McCain says, McNeil, here comes trouble.
Frank McCain, one of the other four of you.
Yes. And we sat there, and the woman came behind McCain and I. She put her hand on his shoulder and on my shoulder and said words like, boys, I'm disappointed in you. And then McCain says, ma'am, why would you be disappointed in me? You don't know me. And that woman said, I'm disappointed at what you're doing because it's taken you so long. And that was like a shot of adrenaline. She, in a sense, was our first outside friend.
So, Dan, what happened next?
Well, the protesters did gain more friends, black and white friends, but they also gained a lot of enemies. And very quickly, people sort of descended on this lunch counter. Within a couple of days, a lot of white townspeople who opposed the protesters were getting there earlier to take all the stools at the lunch counter so that the African-American students and the other protesters could not sit there. They could not wage their protest. And so this went on for days with a mixture of protesters and counter-protesters kind of jockeying for the stools. And if you see photos of the time, I mean, it was jam-packed in there. People who couldn't get stools were standing shoulder to shoulder. And it was just so tense in there, almost as if these people were all just kind of waiting for someone to throw a punch.
Right.
And one of the stories that came out of this that I found especially moving was there was a group of white women at an all-girls college down the road who were inspired by the protesters. They came down to the lunch counter. And when they walked up to the counter, several of the white men who were sitting in stools who were opposed to the African-American protesters gave up their seats for these women because they assumed, oh, well, they must be on our side and we're going to be very gentlemanly and give up our seats. So the women sit down in the seats. The waitress comes over and says, can I take your order? And the women say, well, we're not ordering yet. We think there's some African-American customers who were here before us.
Wow. That was brave back then.
Yeah, very brave. And at the end of the day, they had a moment where they were afraid that they might have gotten in too deep because this place, again, is packed shoulder to shoulder. And they started to wonder, how are we going to get out of here safely? But without them having to say a word, all of a sudden, at closing time, a group of the African-American protesters surrounded them, locked arms, and escorted them safely out of the restaurant where they had a cab waiting for them, put them in the cab, and sent them back to their all-girls school campus.
That's an amazing story. So, Dan, after that, how long did it take Woolworths to finally integrate their lunch counters?
Well, that initial protest was in February. The lunch counter was integrated in July. So it took months of on-and-off protests and frankly, a lot of bad publicity for the lunch counter to finally be integrated, but it led to a wave of integrations at restaurants and lunch counters across the country.
Dan, thank you so much for sharing this with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Melissa.
Dan Pashman is the host of The Sporkful from WMIC Studios. The Sporkful special series, Other People's Food, is available wherever you get your podcasts. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And let me leave you with this thought from Dr. Maya Angelou. She wrote, I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. And this summer, Garrison Keillor, along with Heather Massey, Aoife O'Donovan, Rich Dworsky and the Roadhounds, and Mr. Fred Newman, will be crossing the country with the Prairie Home Love and Comedy Tour. Tickets, locations, info, and more are at prairiehome.org. You can find information on all of our guests and their lives and what they eat at splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table team is made up of senior producer Jennifer Russell and production assistant Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Ludke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.